just not that. But they can hear you.
Okay, so he had his Easter outfit. He was not impressed. So
no,
he's that.
Yeah,
and then, and then he hated his polar bear outfit. Ding, 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 and whale. Not happy.
That's funny.
It's like the April 18th meeting of the Commission on Aging. Will please come to order. Welcome, everyone. We consider it a compliment that you're here and not out grasping at some rays of sun. You all reviewed the agenda. Do I have a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All those against? You've read the minutes dated March 21st. Do I have a motion to approve those, or less are there
so moved.
Changes? Is there a second?
Second.
All those approved?
Aye.
All those opposed? Thank you. Public Health Advisory Committee, the report is, I will be giving them a report this evening on what we did last year and raise the curtain on what we're going to do this year. So I will be speaking there, and they're giving me dinner, so I'm very excited. The Area Aging Agency on Aging and Disabilities. Pat is not with us this evening, but
it's
Linda,
tomorrow.
The
and
meeting
so
is
I'll
tomorrow.
Update it. Yeah, so I'll update you all at the next meeting.
Okay. And there are some pamphlets that Christina Marineris put in the back about Alzheimer's, which is also related to today's discussion. Our speaker this evening is Shanti Potts. She is an instructor at Clark College and a 25-year advocate for seniors and for people with disabilities. Shanti has been a volunteer, a paid employee, and an activist. And I also know she's flexible because a reporter called me the other day wanting to know a little bit more about the meeting tonight. So I put the reporter in touch with Shanti after I called her and she agreed. But she was driving the car back to Vancouver from Central Washington, so I guess you just pulled off the side of the road and made that happen. Anyway, it was on KPAM, and we appreciate that. So thank you for doing that. So welcome, Shanti Potts.
So I'm going to try to keep this interactive, and I've been told I can't move, so it's going to be interesting. But I was asked today to present about the difference between normal and not normal aging. So I'm going to run through a bunch of slides and I'm going to ask some questions too, so we'll get to participate. Anyone who wants to. So when you hear this word dementia, which is one that scares us all sometimes, think about what does that mean to you? Anybody? What does that word dementia mean to you?
Memory loss, forgetfulness.
Okay.
Loss of independence.
Loss of independence, yes.
Loss of touch with reality.
Yeah. So very simply put, the word dementia means something is wrong with my brain, and my brain is not working the way it used to work. That is a key element. It's not working the way it used to work. which means that a person with dementia has reached a level of competency and is now sort of going backwards. When a person has dementia, their brain cells are dying. And as those brain cells die, some of the functions that they did would not be performed. One of the things we know, and we heard that first, was when I said, what does the word dementia mean to you? She said, memory loss. People pick on memory first, because memory is one of the many brain functions, but it's one of the most quantifiable ones. Think about it. You're all up here on the sixth floor. If somebody thought they were in the third floor, we can measure that very easily, right? If I asked you, where did you park your car? Or what color is your car? And you tell me the color of a car you had three times back, but not the color you have right now, I can measure that. So that definitely is one of the things we very easily measure. So the next question becomes, what is the difference between dementia and Alzheimer's disease? Anyone want to take a shot at that?
I sometimes think of it, and this is very simple, as dementia is forgetting where you put the spoon, and Alzheimer's is you forget what the spoon is for.
Close, good. Someone else?
There's also a physical aspect to the Alzheimer's. There is actually a physical problem inside the brain,
right.
Not so much with dementia.
Okay, so all really close. When we talk about the word dementia, it's a very umbrella term. It just means something is wrong with my brain is not working the way it used to work, and because my brain is not working the way it used to work, I have a whole bunch of issues. Alzheimer's is one of about 100 different types of dementia that have been identified. So it is one of the diseases that causes dementia. So if you have Alzheimer's, you have dementia. If you have dementia, you could have Alzheimer's, or you could have one of the other 99 conditions. And in this slide, I've broken them down into the ones that we most see and the most verify: Alzheimer's disease, young onset, and late onset. And when we're talking about young onset, what we mean is when the first early signs and symptoms, not the diagnosis, but when the first early signs and symptoms first show up. And if they first show up before the ages of 60 or 65, that's what's young onset. So we would see something in the early stages, even as low as 40 in someone who has those early signs of dementia. Vascular disease is the second most commonly identified dementia. About 14% of the population have a diagnosis, and it's a very accurate diagnosis for that percentage. Beyond that, we have a lot of the movement disorders, Lewy body's disease, Parkinson's syndrome. We also have frontotemporal lobe dementia. And then the rest of them kind of tend to get clumped into this other category. And we have, of course, genetic syndromes. So this would be, for example, someone who has a family history of Huntington's, where there is a very high percentage of a mother passing it on to a child, so on and so forth. We also have metabolic inheritance. That would be someone with a developmental disability, whether it was autism spectrum disorder, a seizure convulsion disorder, could be intellectual disability, could be, you know, combination of physical and mental intellectual disability, things like that. And then Korsakoff syndrome, or also called, also very similar to alcohol-related dementia. It's the body's inability to assimilate a particular vitamin, vitamin B1. Then we have, you know, toxins and drugs that can cause people to have damage to the brain because they kind of party too much. We have white matter diseases, infections. Infectious diseases would be things like Creutzfeldt-Jakob's disease, which is a very insidious brain infection that from onset to the end of life can be as little as 18 months in time. Some of the other dementias, Pick's disease, traumatic brain injury, which is a big group in there. Because a traumatic brain injury is a very complex disorder. It can be from the inside, can be from the outside, can be something that happened a long time ago. Yesterday I met with a lady who was telling me about her young child who had had meningitis as a child, and in her early 30s developed a brain disorder associated with dementia from that meningitis. And she also had some other issues. And that's the other thing about dementia, is it's rare to have one very pure form of dementia. And then, of course, psychiatric disorders. So someone who has struggled with the fluctuations of schizophrenia, for example, or anxiety syndrome disorders, or mood and affective disorders in their later life can develop some aspects of dementia. So pretty vast, lots of other types too that I haven't mentioned. Is there one that you have heard of that isn't up there?
So usually the way we do this is we have presentation to the commission, primarily,
okay.
The commission members. It is an official meeting and part of the record, as well as by CBTV. So people in our audience aren't used to being asked to participate at this point, but your turn will come. So we are about collecting information.
Okay.
This whole focus is on supportive services, and we really want to drill down on it.
Yeah.
And one of the questions we will be having is, how do we use what we learned from you as we make our recommendations to the county council a year from now?
Okay.
So
no questions?
Yeah, well, we'll get to that. We'll get
okay.
to that, yeah.
Okay.
So keep your questions, because we know that everybody's interested that is here this evening. So we will take time for that, because you are key to our discussions as well. So we'll just go from there. How's that, Shanti?
Okay, I can do this. Okay, so then what you're looking at right now is a scan of the brain. It's a MRI scan of the brain. And as you can see very clearly, it's reflected in what's going on with activity in the brain. When there is activity in the brain, we see red, which is go, go, go. And next from that is the oranges and the yellows. But by the time we get to the purples and the grays, there's not much going on at that point. And of course, the brain to your left is a healthy, normal brain. Right to the right is pretty significant deficits associated with Alzheimer's disease. So when we talk about dementia, when we're trying to figure out what it means to the rest of us, we look at what I would call the ABC of understanding what's going on with the person. A is activities of daily living. So people who have dementia struggle with the activities of daily living, the things you and I do every day for ourselves, on our own, without any assistance. At a very high functional level, that could be managing your environment. It's too hot, it's too cold, adjusting the temperature. The next three go together almost, and we call them the M&M&Ms: money management, medication management, and meal management. And then beyond that is the real world of dementia. So in that, we would look at three specific groups: mobilities and transfers. We would look at toileting and mobilities and transfers, toileting and continence, and the basic grooming, dressing, hygiene that a person would need. People with dementia also have difficulty with behaviors. They behave in ways that may not be the way they behaved in the past, or may not be what conforms to what we have accepted in our individual cultures as social norms. And finally, people with dementia will have other brain functions, cognitive functions, that do not work the way they have worked in the past. So let's take a look at just one of those brain functions, so we can get an idea about how complex the disorder can be, and also how complex it can be to understand and conceptualize what might go on with a particular person. So we've all heard of memory loss, and a couple of you mentioned it earlier. Memory loss, right? Forgetting. Memory loss can be broken down into a couple different scenarios. We have recent memory loss, which is, what did I have for breakfast this morning? Where did I park my car? Where am I right now? We have remote memory loss, which is the old memories. Where did I go to school? Where did I graduate college? What did I do for a job? And then we have a different but unique kind of memory loss that occurs, very, very common in, for example, vascular disease, where the person has holes in their memory. Events are just lost. So you may have taken a trip to Hawaii, and it may have been the highlight of your existence, but if you've had a stroke, or some kind of vascular event in that area of the brain where that memory is stored, you wouldn't remember if you went to Hawaii. You'd look at pictures of yourself and you would create a new memory, but you wouldn't have that memory. Memory is also broken down into types in terms of how we process. So we have things called declarative memory. Declarative memory is what's your name, where you live, what's your social security number. Things you say and respond to with a little bit of memory, but mostly it comes out as. And then we have non-declarative memory. Non-declarative memory is memory you use when you need to do math, basically. So if you are good at those Sudoku puzzles, you are great at non-declarative memory. And if you're good at crossword puzzles, where they give you little phrases and you have to come up with words, that's declarative memory. So as you can see, memory is very, very complex. I want to read this to you. So this is Oakland Earl, and Earl is whistling a tune, walking back to his house where his wife is standing at the mailbox, and she says, "Where have you been, Earl?" He says, "I went to the gas station to fill up the car." She says, "Where is it? Where's the car?" "Oh, shoot." Earl forgot the car at the gas station. Now, hopefully none of us have done this, but we've had those moments where we walk into a room and can't remember why you got there, right? So for those of you that I have scared off right now, one of the things we say is if you forgot and it came back, you're okay. If you forgot and it didn't, you're not, but you don't know anyway. If you forgot and it's taking longer and longer to come back, you need to run, not walk, to your doctor's office. Because memory in itself, as one of the brain functions, is very, very complex. We have sensory memory, and short-term, and long-term, and explicit, and implicit. And in order to test this one brain function, these are all of the areas of just memory that I have to test to figure out where you are. And once I get that data, I can use it to figure out exactly what's wrong with you, and then from that, exactly what kind of help you might need. So as we look at some of the other brain functions, we have beyond memory things like orientation, coordination, judgment, language, large motor skills, small, fine motor skills, calculation, and the list goes on. And so when we are reviewing to decide if something's going on with you, we need to look at all of those. And then it's not that simple again, because memory and all of the brain functions are unique to you and I. And what I experience might not be what anybody else experiences. So I not only have to be able to check where you were, but I need to figure out where you are at now. So history becomes very important. So for example, if I were checking your skills and you lived in Vancouver, I would know that you had driven a car, and so I would check your driving skills. But if you lived in New York and you never drove a car, but you navigated the subway system really well, I would check to see how you navigated various systems. So even within testing, it can be so unique to each person. And we need a good person to tell us where you are at and what's been going on with you. So with Alzheimer's disease, as you can see, right there in the hippocampus, and I don't know, there's my hippocampus right there, that's where Alzheimer's disease starts, which is also the part of the brain that processes recent memories. That part of the brain keeps, stores, and processes the last 48 to 72 hours of your experience. So if you take a look inside the brain, the frontal lobe is responsible for movement and emotion and behavior and remote memories, that is the old or the long-term memories, thinking, speech, and writing. It's the chief executive officer in your brain. If that part of your brain were not working today and you were driving here and you saw red and blue lights behind you, and if it wasn't working, that part of your brain would say, go for it. You can outrun this guy. But if it's working, it says, pull over, behave yourself, and if you're really nice, maybe you can talk your way out of this deal. Then we have the parietal lobe. The parietal lobe is responsible for sensations of pressure and temperature and body part awareness. And this part of the brain is responsible for helping you gauge whether you want to put on a sweater or take it off. This is the part of your body that helps you balance as you walk and move around. This is the part of your body that needs adjustment when you go up on high elevations. And then there's the temporal lobe, responsible for interpreting sounds and spoken words and emotions and recent memories. Remember, this is the place of Alzheimer's. And then we have the occipital lobe in the back, responsible for visual images and the meaning of the spoken word. So for example, when I say the word pink elephants, and you get a picture in the back of your mind of a pink elephant, it came because that part of your brain is really working. So I love to use this analogy of the bowl of strawberries, because your brain is kind of like that. What happens if you have a bowl of strawberries and a strawberry that got a little bit too ripe sitting next to a strawberry that's happy and fresh? It goes bad, right? The same thing happens in your brain. You have brain cells that are dying sitting next to not so happy brain cells. And guess what happens to those happy brain cells, those well brain cells? They start to die too. They start to get contaminated. And unlike the bowl of strawberries, you can't reach in there and pull something out. Makes it very complex. So what is normal as we get older, given all of these other factors? Forgetting names is very normal. Increased time to learn or to do something that's new. Decreased ability in terms of dexterity and multitasking, switching from one task to another and going back and forth with competency. And the ability to remember and pull back data, like, where did you park your car today? And decreased response and reactionary time. It takes a couple more microseconds to pick your foot up off the gas and hit the brake when you see the light change. And to learn in a short amount of time. And decreased quality of time learned, of time spent in any new kind of learning. That's all normal to do as we get older. And when we say older, we mean 60 and 70 and 80 and sometimes even 90, because everyone's different. But then something happens, and that something can be anything. When that something happens, we move from what we would call normal aging into a period where we would notice an increase in the issues that come around from the disability to work with what's going on. So we call it the gray area. This person starts to feel more and more overwhelmed. They have some very subjective memory complaints. They can say things like, I opened this box that I ordered in the mail, and I have no memory of ordering it. I walked into my bedroom, and I opened the closet door thinking it was the bathroom. Things you should know. Increased irritability, decreased stress, some new depression, some new withdrawals, some decreased mood, all of these things. When we are in crisis, this is what happens. Yes, so for example, right now, I'm pretty excited to be here. Sun is shining, fairly good day. Things are going really well with my presentation, I think, right? In a decreased mood, a person would have maybe a lack of initiation, not able to do something that normally I would be able to do. So for example, it's a nice sunny day, I'm finished with work, I can go outside and enjoy the sunshine. I might choose to just sit in my chair because I just don't, there's just not that desire to go. If someone has depression, that could increase. If someone has anxiety, that could increase. And then we work our way into the land of dementia. In the land of dementia, people get lost in familiar situations. The grocery store that they go to all the time, that same path that they have taken for 10 years just isn't familiar anymore, and they take one wrong turn and land up in Bellevue or some other place like that. The person is confused, anxious, sometimes depressed, and withdrawn. Awareness deficit of their own issues. They feel like they're fine. They feel like there's nothing wrong with me, I'm okay. And they might live in denial about many of the things that are going on.
They repeat bits and pieces of information, or they tell the same stories over and over because they don't remember they've told them. And it's an interesting story because it's at the top of my brain and it's top of my mind right now. And they have lost interest in previously enjoyed hobbies. And it's very interesting in this case that awareness deficit kicks in. So when you ask the person who golfs 3 days a week and has done it since retirement for the last 10 years, how often do you golf? They'll say, I go 3 times a week, because they remember that piece. And then you say, when did you go last? And they say, oh, not this week, but you know, last week I went. And then when you check with the spouse, they haven't gone in 6 months. That kind of thing. And then there's increased stress again. Of course, look at all the stuff that's happening to you, right? You're going to be more stressed. You're going to be more anxious. And then the other piece of this is immediate family. Family who have real interactions with you will recognize the deficits or the losses or the changes. But those family members that you meet for very short times, who maybe are, you know, hi, how are you over the telephone, will think you're fine. In fact, they will tell the other family members who are with you all the time, I don't know what you're complaining about. She seems okay. In this, everyone responds with a couple of different things. We bring our personalities to the table. So I have a short story to tell you about personalities. I tend to be a really mellow person. I go with the flow. Not much upsets me. I also feel like, you know, the world is basically a good place with a few bad people. My husband, on the other hand, is kind of worrisome. He feels he's the protector of our family. He tends to be a little more negative. He thinks the world is filled with bad people, with a few good people. So, a couple weeks ago, I was cold when I woke up. I went to change the thermostat to heat it up, and I realized the door between the house and the garage was open. So I shut it and went to bed. And that was the end of my version of the story. But a week later, my husband said, honey, when you go to bed, don't forget to lock the door. And as soon as he said that, I realized he must have had the same experience I had. Woke up cold, went to find the thermostat, found the door open. And then he went on to tell me, he goes, yeah. So I went and I found my gun and I checked the perimeter on the outside and I checked the perimeter on the inside and I locked up everything and I went to bed. And I thought, how did you sleep after that? So we bring our personalities to the table. Now, let's fast forward both of us, maybe 20 years, maybe 30 years from now, in the world of dementia. I will be the little old lady running around, closing all the doors and going to bed. My husband will be the gentleman who is looking for his gun, and when he cannot find it, very aggressive because the caregiver is telling him, it's okay, it's fine, I got it, I've got it, go to bed. And he hasn't done finding his gun or checking the perimeter. So personality plays a big role in how we would respond in any of those situations, in addition to all of this other stuff that goes on with us. So sometimes people ask me this next question. They say, how is dementia diagnosed? And one of the things we know about dementia is that the worst way to get diagnosed is to go to your primary care, tell a story, and get a diagnosis. What we would like to happen is for you to go to your primary care and for them to rule out any of the other possible reasons why you could be having that memory loss, that confusion, that depression, that agitation, that anxiety, that getting lost, or any of the other symptoms that you have. And once they have ruled those out, we want them to send you to a psychiatrist who will do some scanning and some testing and find out if maybe you have a very well-managed mental disorder like depression or anxiety that needs treatment now because you're getting older and you just can't manage it on your own without help. And beyond that, we want them to send you to a neurologist who will actually look inside of your brain and see what's going on, if anything's going on. And we want them to have you see and meet an occupational therapist who will determine if you are safe at home or if you are one accident away from breaking a hip or a shoulder or landing up in nursing type care when you could have been safer for a few grab bars and some other adjustments. And beyond that, we want you to meet a social worker, someone who will connect you with social services and support groups and other opportunities that might be available in the community to help you to stay as independently as possible in your home for as long as possible. And that can be done with MMSE tests and fMRIs and PET scans and CAT scans and mini mental state exams and clock drawing tests and functional assessment tests, and there are a variety of tests that can be used. So if you got your diagnosis from going to a primary care physician to whom you told a story, you might get put into a category for something you don't have. And so the second question is, why is that important? And it's very important because, one, if you don't know what's going on with you, how do we treat you? How do we treat that condition? And two, if something is going on and you get the wrong treatment, would it make your condition worse? And in many cases it can, and it does. There are many medications that are completely contraindicated for one thing that can be very beneficial for something else. So we want to know. And you have kids, and you have family. And if we don't have that history today, maybe we will fix you, but maybe we can fix them. So for all those reasons, it's really important to spend the time to get that good diagnosis. Another way you don't get the diagnosis is by talking to someone, and family members and friends who are very helpful like to do that for you. They'll say, I just had this great conversation. And sometimes if you really are skilled at listening, you'll realize that the person has been convincing people on a one-time meet very well. But the second time, or later in the day, or over an extended period of time, that doesn't happen because the social chit-chat and banter ability that we have remains. I have a guy that tells 5 jokes. They're very intricate jokes, and that's all he can do. But if he meets you for the first time and you hear those jokes, you better believe he's fine. But then you take him home, and then you'll really find out what's going on. The next question I get asked is, how common is dementia, and who gets dementia? And this is one of the things about dementia, unlike any other condition, age takes precedence over family history. The older you get, the higher your potential. At the age of 65, 10% of the population have dementia. When that number gets to 75, it goes up to 35%, and at 85, it's at 50%. So the longer you live, the higher your risk. Followed by, of course, family history. And if you have a metabolic or a genetic disorder, that immediately puts you in the running. But there are other factors. Having high blood pressure that is unmanaged, up and down, up and down. Diabetes, numbers in the 600s, numbers in the 400s. Or any of these conditions that are unmanaged can cause damage to your brain. Because brain, if you think about it, is very, very, very delicate. In fact, if you really look at the human body, we have a cage for our, what we call our vital organs. But our brain has a pretty strong case because it is so delicate. And it has, beyond that, other barriers, chemical barriers, the blood-brain barrier, for example, that really protects the brain from anything. So it's very delicate. And any time you aren't taking care of your secondary health, you can cause deficits. Dementia is broken down into 3, if you will, phases: mild, moderate, and severe. In the mild phase, we're looking at about 2 to 4 years of the person's timeline. In a 20-year timeline, for example, we are also looking at moderate difficulty. This person still lives at home, a lot of the time still in denial. And it isn't until something really big happens, there's an event, person falls, person gets lost, that they are taken to the doctor and we get a diagnosis. But most of the time, the diagnosis doesn't occur in this phase because we talk. The middle phase is the phase in which, it's called the longest phase. It can last up to 12 to 14 years. A lot of what's happening in this phase is a person is losing functional ability. Behaviors start to occur. This is the phase at which the family members say, we can't do this anymore, we need help, and they will hire someone, or they will even place someone. And the end phase is the last 1 to 3 years ending in death, where this person receives more than 80% of their care from someone else. And if you look in this Alzheimer's grouping, it started right there, and then it started to spread. The strawberries went all the way through the brain. Between the healthy and the severe Alzheimer's, a person can lose one-third of their brain mass. That's a lot. And so then the last question is, what can you do? And in the interest of time, I actually created a handout called Staying Sharp that I didn't create, somebody else created, I just folded. And there's a lot of good information in that. But what are some of the things you can do? Take care of your brain. One of the favorite sayings we have is, you know, protecting that brain. So sports injuries are a big part of dementia. And they may have happened when you were young, but you're going to pay the price now. So be careful. Keeping your secondary health managed. What's good for your heart is also good for your brain. So that healthy eating and that exercise is all important for you. Keep your brain challenged, because the brain is a use it or lose it deal. If you're not using it, those brain cells will say, okay, I'm in retirement now, I can shut down. So challenging yourself, doing those puzzles, driving home by a different route are all beneficial. Everything in moderation, including moderation. Remember that? It's really important when it comes to brain health that we do everything in moderation. This is not what you have control over, but good genes. If you could, you would, right? And finally, start at birth. A lot of times people walk up to me and, you know, they're 70 or 80 and they'll say, I heard this thing about avocados, or I heard this thing about coconut oil. And my response is, try it. And if it works for you, keep doing it. But in my head, I'm thinking, you should have started a long time ago. I'm done, so if you have any questions.
Okay. So, members of the commission, do you have questions? Bill.
Have you had much interaction with the work of the Amen Clinic in relationship to dementia?
Dr. Daniel Amen.
Yeah, with their spec scan and so on. Yes. What's your take on that?
He's very good. Unfortunately, with the world of dementia, what people do is wait till they're so far gone that there isn't much. And that tends to be it. But with mental disorders, depression, things like that, he really does have a lot of good help and support that can be provided.
Well, I was looking at a thing today on his website because I was talking with a friend about somebody he was working with dementia, and I asked him that question. On their website, they say that, like with depression, they could much more quickly figure out which drugs would or wouldn't be helpful.
Right. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot for dementia. We really don't. And because we wait so late to start. The other thing about the drugs is that they have up to a 4-year efficacy at the outside for most people. The rule of thirds, of course, applies, but within that, they would just have that short frame of time. So if you don't take them early.
Yeah.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Donna?
Thank you, that was interesting. Do you have any statistics about the number of older people who actually remain in their homes versus those who do not?
So remain in their homes across the board. Americans take care of 67% of their elderly in their homes. But I don't know that there's a specific statistic about the dementia numbers. Just because, like we were saying, you know, towards the end, at some point, there is a considerable amount of care required. Thinking of how it progresses, you know, in the last 2 years, this person might be the equivalent of a 6-month-old baby. And so in those cases, how, you know, and then of course some people don't make it to that point for various reasons.
But is it not possible that many of us age and we never really get dementia?
Absolutely.
So what is that percentage? I need some hope here.
So if you're over the age of 65, and I know you're not, it would be 50%. You could be in the other group at the worst. If it's 75, it's 35. If it's 65, it's 10. and it's in the between at 65 and 75 we're looking at mild to moderate. It's not until 85 that we're looking at moderate to severe spectrum.
So if you lie about your age, you can keep hanging in.
Right.
Allie?
Yeah. Thank you for your presentation. It's really good. And I really appreciated how you highlighted the complexity of diagnosing dementia. Do you see it common of primary care providers diagnosing the dementia?
You mean, yes, I do.
Without going through those series of steps?
I do.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
You know, unfortunately, physicians tend to want to fix things.
Yes.
And when we're talking about dementia, it's not fixable.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't do management very well. Mm-hmm. They want that done by someone else. And so, yes, unfortunately, the other piece of this is that, you know, a lot of times by the time people come to their physicians, they are so advanced in both age and the ability to tolerate any of the testing.
Mm-hmm.
That physicians feel like it would be wasted, if you will, in terms of, okay, then what do you do?
Yeah.
And so sometimes that isn't. And then, of course, you know, a lot of times primary care physicians have known their person to be what we would call maladjurant through their everyday secondary health protocol. So what would make us think that they would suddenly be, you know, running out there to run and walk and breathe deeply and do all those things that would be beneficial? So. That those are all factors that go into it. But yes, in fact, if you look at the numbers of people, most people get diagnosed with Alzheimer's. It's at 56% when not all 56% have exclusively Alzheimer's. They may have memory loss, and they may have components of it, but not always.
And just to,
many times it's frontal lobe, things like that, that mask Lewy body disease in the early stages that masks as Alzheimer's.
And just to emphasize, dementia is not a normal part of aging.
Absolutely not a normal part of aging, no. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Marion?
Shanti, many years ago, I heard someone say that the only way Alzheimer's could be diagnosed is at an autopsy. Is that no longer true, or was it ever?
For an absolute diagnosis, yes, it is. Yes, it is. That's the only way to diagnose Alzheimer's, but not all of the dementias. So, for example, with Huntington's, we can get a blood test. Parkinson's, you can do a spinal tap. So it is still one of the rule-out, we call it a rule-out condition. And once you've ruled everything else out, you know, Sherlock Holmes, what remains must be true kind of thing. So that's where we are with Alzheimer's still. And the reason for it is What we fail to recognize is that in the early stage, we may have started in one area of the brain, but if the strawberries took effect in another, we wouldn't know, and people wait so long. That is probably our biggest, biggest issue, is people wait so long because they think, if I don't go near a doctor, I won't have it, or, you know. And we also cope, we cope, you know. It applies to everything, cataracts. People have surgery and they're like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize how much I couldn't see, right? You cope, hearing deficits, because it comes out so gradually and we cope every day. And we find that, you know, people who have great spouses who are very supportive, wait longer. It's not so good to have that partner who always holds you up and, you know, may not bring to light something that could be looked at.
Bill?
Shanti,
yes.
Can you speak to the whole cognitive reserve thing, you know, like with the chess player, that classic illustration, or the convent in New England and so forth, where they found people with all the tangles and so forth of advanced Alzheimer's, and yet they were functioning incredibly well because they had such a large cognitive reserve?
Well, we are born with 100 billion brain cells. And every one of us pretty much gets the same number. But every time we have a life experience, we create synaptic connections. And the more connections we have, the more complex those connections are, the quicker we are, for example, at multitasking, the smarter we are considered in classrooms because we process and have an answer right away, all of those things. And so when we are looking at someone who has that much that complex an issue, they're pretty high up there. so there's a long way for them to fall to the bottom. That said, it also depends on what area of the brain. So for example, in the Nunn study, what, I'm not gonna remember his name, but David came up with was the fact that they had such a ritualistic routine life. And within those confines, they did great. But think about the rest of us who have the stresses of the world.
Yeah.
There's a big difference there. You know, stress has been, and just what stress does in terms of the raised adrenaline levels and all of that, is so detrimental to the brain. And in the Nunn study, for example, they didn't have, you know, they knew where their meals were coming from, and they didn't worry about money necessarily. It wasn't, you know, it was more of a collective concern. And they found the same thing in people who live in these big communes, or these, you know, that the because of the shared responsibilities, people uphold each other much longer too. So,
which really actually speaks to the importance of neighborhood and community and all of that, like that Jewish
exactly
group and so forth.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. I can't say enough about how wonderful it would be if we could have something like that.
Yeah.
You know, a place that would hold up people not to have to worry. Unfortunately, it's not a perfect situation because a lot of times people who have these worries and then develop, say, a memory condition, live in that worry over and over. So, you know, it isn't quite the same as the examples that we use, say, in the Nunn study or the place in Germany where it's that whole village.
Yeah.
But that's because they have recognized it to be a genetic metabolic factor for their whole community. There is a much higher incidence of specifically Alzheimer's disease in, and I don't want to say this wrong, but white German descent.
Interesting.
Just one more question. Recently, there was news about a breakthrough, I believe in Japan, where they had been able to blast some of the plaques in the brain and bring back memories. What can you tell us about that?
So that is actually Australia. I don't know if Japan is also borrowing the technology, but there's a doctor in Australia who is using ultrasound. So his hypothesis, if you will, is that these plaques and tangles that form these bad strawberries, and I love the strawberry analogy, so I'm gonna use it a lot, but those bad strawberries contaminate the good strawberries. When we're younger, we also have bad strawberries, but the brain has elements within the brain where there are certain chemicals in our body that cross the blood-brain barrier, go into the brain, and clean out the gunk, if you will, the plaques, like going into the dentist. And when we get older, the blood-brain barrier becomes lazy, if you will, for want of a better term, and so it doesn't break down at the appropriate time to allow those chemicals to do their job, and then it just fills up. So he's using, if that's the same one you're talking about, he's using ultrasound to break down the blood-brain barrier. So people have a non-invasive treatment. You go in, you sit in a chair, they break down the blood-brain barrier using ultrasound, the chemicals go into your brain, they clean it out, and you get successive treatments based upon how fast you're making the plaques and tangles. So right now it's about 3 months is the average. So some people might go a little bit earlier, some people might go a little bit later. But it's not science that has come to the US because we are very heavily drug company driven. So it'll take us a while, but.
Members of the audience, do you have questions?
I just,
Jackie will bring the microphone there.
The list of things that you should do, starting with your primary care and moving on down the line. The last thing you said was social worker. Now maybe y'all know that you can go to your phone book and look up the word social worker and there'll be a number and you can call them and say it's time. But most of us don't know how to do that. And so what kind of social worker, I mean, who would you call at that point?
So if you're in Vancouver, most of our clinics, so the Kaiser system, the Vancouver Clinic system, the Hudson's Bay system, and I'm not going to remember the rest of the systems, actually have social workers. So call your doctor's office, ask to speak to his or her assistant or medical whatever person, and say, can I have the number for your social worker? Because most of them have them. And that person would connect you. You could also, of course, I'm going to do a shameless plug, call our agency, the Area Agency on Aging. That's what they do. They give you these resources. They tell you about the support groups. They connect you with, you know, they ask you questions. They connect you with what you can, what you're entitled to. Benefits checkup, they will help you through that. So you can figure out not just the, you know, emotional support kind of systems that are out there, mental health systems, but also some of the financial pieces that can be put into place for you.
Other questions?
Hi, Shanti, thanks for the interesting presentation. If you could wave your magic wand and...
can you speak into the microphone? It's directional, so speak into it. Yeah.
If you could wave your magic wand and be able to channel the resources of our older population in support of people that have dementia or in the community as a whole, what are the ways that you would want to have volunteers help? What are the kinds of community structures we need to be thinking of putting in place? In other words, if we're forward thinking, I know the commission is here for that, what are the things that we need to be aware of that can be done?
So Christina's handing you a piece of paper that will be very helpful. we have a great program that actually Christina is in charge of bringing to fruition, and they couldn't have picked a better person. That is my magic wand. We are a long ways. You know, I'm very proud to live in the state of Washington, because in terms of the services and things like that, and I feel like I'm saying this over and over, so forgive me if I've said it before to this group. In terms of the services that are available to people that are seniors or people with disabilities, we rank second in the nation. It was an AARP number at a cost that is 38th in the nation, which shows we're not only forward thinking, but we're also fiscally responsible. So we are making steps in that direction. I'm so excited when I see that our university, University of Washington, sends out so many different supportive programs and, you know, offers them through their graduate programs at almost no cost to the various people, the agencies on aging and the other support systems. So it's not a one-line answer. We're doing it. Come support us, you know. Say how important it is and then support us. One of the things that's saddest for me actually is when we bring services and they die away because there are people out there but no one uses them, because this tends to be a condition that people really, you know, they don't want to know about it till they're in it, and when they're in it, it's too much. And so, you know, getting ahead of the game becomes, yes, Christina.
The only thing that I would add to that, addressing the question of how can I as the individual help be a part of the solution, if you have members in your faith community, members in your family, your extended friendship networks, and you know that they or a family member has dementia, it's just coming forward and saying, hey, I want to be supportive, and can I come over and visit, can I come over and make a meal? So often our family caregivers, there's just so much that they have to do, and they don't want to burden anybody, so they don't ask. And so when you come forward and you're proactive and you offer what it is that you can do, that can be awesome. I think volunteering with agencies or initiatives that are looking to do those supportive services is another wonderful way to do that.
Bob.
Three questions, if I may, if I can remember. How well is our community doing, dealing with this afflicted population?
On a scale of 1 to 10, I'd say about a 7. I'd say about a 7 right now. Okay. We're doing fairly well.
Second question, is the percentage of this afflicted population going to increase in the near future?
Yes. if you take the numbers, and I like numbers, if you take the numbers for Alzheimer's disease, we have 5,500,000 people in the state of, in the country, in the US that have Alzheimer's disease. 500,000 are late onset, so older population. 500,000, I said that right, 5 million is older population, 500,000 is young onset. And we say that people who are diagnosed with Alzheimer's are about 56%, so that would mean we have about 10 million people. By 2050, we will have 16 million people with Alzheimer's, so we're going to go at about 35 million with dementia.
Third question. Looking to the future, based on what you've just said, how well are we doing to prepare ourselves to deal with the population coming up?
Well,
using a scale of 1 to 10.
You have this great commission here, and I think, again, you know, I remember way back, I went to the first, very first conference that they had, and I can't even tell you how many years ago it was, but it was a very long time ago, because I know this because the gentleman said, if you're over the age of 50, stand up, and then he said, under the age of 50, stand up. And when he said that, he said, you have the potential to live to 120. And I was able to stand up, so it was a long time ago. And since then, I mean, I find that we've done a very good job. So again, scale of 1 to 10, I'm going to go with a 7. Someone else might give it another scale, I don't know.
So we have 3 to go.
Hopefully this group will push that and make sure we get there.
Well, I've been, since Pat Jen asked me to do this, I went back and read some of the reports that they have published on their website, which, by the way, are really very interactive and cool. So they've done a lot, even in these, since 2013, 14, 15, 16.
There's a question there, and then there'll be one in the back, Jackie.
Do you see anything changing for insurance companies in providing care for dementia patients versus home health care agencies that provide private pay, but it's not covered under the insurance aspect?
I wish there was more. I don't. I see them as putting, in my opinion, and maybe this is just me, very, what I see, you know, sometimes when you work in a world, you see just the negative, and sometimes you may see. So in the world I work in, and I help a lot at the Elder Justice Center, what I see is insurance companies putting more and more loopholes to have you buy the policy and then get out of sometimes meeting all of what the salesperson talked to you into buying in the first place. And again, I want to say that just from what I have seen, and it could be that I am just seeing, you know, because I see the complaints. So it could be that. I'm talking long-term care policies. I don't believe that Medicare will get to the place where they will cover custodial care. Custodial care in hospice, maybe, and that's even stretching it, but custodial care in any other venue would debilitate our system just because of the vast numbers. We have, you know, 10,000 people every day. That would just take it away. And what we are seeing more and more in dementia is that the numbers for young onset are increasing. So that's scary because we would have more, you know, more people with those conditions. We don't know yet. This, you know, hypothesis, it's a mutation, it's this, it's that. We don't know that, but we're seeing those numbers increase. So from where I stand, I don't think I would say that they're going to cover any more than they are right now.
Next question back there.
I absolutely agree with you that a 7 is a really good guess on that scale, with the exception of people that have behavioral difficulties. If you compound the diagnosis with any sort of behavioral difficulty, placement becomes impossible. To my knowledge, and I could be wrong, I think there's only 2 facilities here in Vancouver that will accept people that have dementia that are on Medicaid. that maybe have behavioral difficulties, and you're lucky if they take them at all with behavioral difficulties. Sometimes the hospital is discharging people as far as Longview or Spokane to find a place that's willing to accept these people. So I don't know if you can really answer this or if it was more just a comment, but I guess my thought is there a vision for Vancouver to have a Medicaid-friendly dementia community, or are we just going to be stuck with the same two systems?
So I can speak to that a little bit, only because when we first had, you know, Legacy even thinking about coming to Clark County, we started having those discussions. I'm a member of the Advisory Council for the Agency on Aging, and I formed a coalition in that agency looking into the geriatric, psychiatric care that is non-existent, if you will, in the Southwest Washington region. In those days, you know, aside from the whole issue with dumping at Forest Grove, with Tuolumne, or a couple of the other small places, we had to go all the way up to the King County area. Highline, Auburn Regional, those were our places. Now, Olympia opened the place, and it was full the day they did ribbon cutting, right? So we know there's a need, and sad to say, when we have had those conversations, one person actually on the record, off the record, said, it's not going to happen, there's no money for it. And that, unfortunately, is our reality. We tried, and we did a lot of work with a couple of attorneys trying to put, you know, because people go by numbers, right, follow the money. And we tried to put numbers in terms of the losses they were incurring, even in the emergency rooms and things like that, because of these. So Olympia has come about, but it's so slow. And I don't see, I haven't heard any real talk in Clark County that we have that option. That said, I have to say that, and I know that, you know, there are only two, but that said, the state, as in DSHS, has opened up their vision for looking at adult family homes, because they actually are better settings, and in reality they are better settings for people with the behaviors, because they get the more consistent caregiver specialized care. I know a lot of people have issues, who, you know, but the bottom line is none versus something, we're working there. And they're also looking at increasing the reimbursement rates with assessments. So that is in the works. Maybe not as fast as you and I wanted, but it's getting there.
Is there another question?
Yes, please. For quality of life for the person with dementia and their caregiver, I think there's some research on the different aspects of what makes a person happy, like all the senses, music, dancing, moving, being outdoors, smelling the citrus, all of that can be woven together, so it's not one single string you can pull out of the spaghetti bowl. It's a lot of different programs when you're in the mild to moderate. Can you speak to that, please?
Well, you know, we take in data through our senses. And as we get more and more into the moderate to the severe stages, our senses are some of the areas that have deficit. And part of it is a use it or lose it. So sensory stimulation is, you know, what wakes up the brain at that point. So if you're talking art therapy, if you're talking bed therapy, it's what makes that person, what brings joy to that person. And like you say, everyone's unique, everyone's going to find their own little niche. We have a lot of programs like that. Again, how do we pay for some of those and how do we access them? But there are services and there are programs, and of course music is, you know, a whole, the studies, if you've heard Oliver, I'm really bad in all these authors, my first name, Musicopelia is his book.
Oliver Sacks,
Musicopelia is his book, and it talks about the value of music and the positivity that music brings and how, you know, waking people up with music as opposed to drawing the curtains back, pulling the sheets off, you know, those kinds of things are so beneficial. So there is an awareness, and people can, you know, find those resources in our community right now available, cost being not the factor.
So, Mom, do you have questions 4, 5, and 6?
The answer to money and insurance is long-term insurance. That at least takes care of the facility, and usually the facility costs are several thousand dollars, and the medical maybe gets picked up later. But everybody 50 years older ought to take out long-term insurance, because it'll pay off when you're 70.
Yep.
There's another question over there. And then over here.
I just wanted to make a comment based on what she said. I know the Portland Art Museum has a program for Alzheimer's patients and their caregivers.
There's a question over here, Jackie.
You touched a little bit on how people's personalities change when they get Alzheimer's, you mentioned. And I wonder if you could talk more specifically about that. For instance, if a person has a narcissistic personality or controlling personality and they're used to being in charge, when they have dementia, do they not know that anymore? Do they get stressed because they can't do the things they used to do, they can't motivate people? Does that stress quicken the dementia?
So, in terms of personality and how people respond, it's across the board and there isn't any set rule. People who are really aggressive and, like you said, narcissistic, antisocial, have borderline personality disorder, can, in dementia, become sweet little old people. And people who are sweet little old people can become not so nice. It depends where in the brain the deficit is. It depends on how that person copes. Like I was saying with my husband, you know, 9 times out of 10, he'll be the one hitting the caregiver and getting medication for his seemingly, you know, aggressive behavior, because his caregiver didn't understand that if she just went with him and talked to him instead of telling him it's gonna be fine and settle down. You know, so there's those factors. We saw that a lot. I did a lot of memory care long-term at the end of life, and we would have these sweet people and the staff would come to me and say, she's so nice. Why is her family not even wanting to come at the very end? And, you know, we don't know which last bridge she burned to make them not want to do that. And it's not really for us to judge, because when we're doing the care, and that's what my role is, we meet you where you are. There's no judgments, so. But some people can get worse, and some people can not. Yes?
Question over here.
I know this has been very specific, and I just wanted to ask the question about globally. It's my understanding from what I've read that the United States and Northern Europe are the places where dementia is much greater than anywhere else in the world. Do you know why that is? I haven't been able to figure that out.
Partially because we're living longer. And you know, as much as no one wants to talk about it, many disease conditions are very color oriented. So if you're Caucasian, you can have a higher incidence of certain diseases, and dementias tend to be that. But it's second to the fact that we are, as a population, living longer. We also have very poor eating habits and exercise habits and stress management habits and all of those things. So, you know, it's not a one thing answer. It can be a multitude of those things. You know, you won't have dementia in Africa because they don't live that long. China has some, you know, they do live. Japan, China, we do have some long lifers, but in much of the tropics, life, people don't live as long. So you might have seen it if they had lived that long. So in the populations, numbers-wise, we are across the board pretty much the same in terms of like genetic studies. They show that the person has the Alzheimer's gene, but they didn't live long enough for it to activate for that person to develop.
Okay, thank you so much.
I just wanted to announce that the handout and Shanti's presentation are posted on our website. So if you go to www.clark.law.gov/aging and look for our 2017 Supportive Speaker Series, with her name, her information, all that is there. And if you have any problems finding that, just come see me and I'll email it to you or get it to you another way. So just wanted to let everyone know.
Thank you, Jackie. So we have two items of business. Policy revisions. Is there a motion for the policy revisions?
Yes, I'd like to make a motion to delete policy 4.0 treasurer, as we changed our bylaws and no longer need that, as well as deleting references of a communication officer in our policy 2.0 communication.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? And regarding a bylaw amendment, is there a proposed bylaw amendment? Article 2, bullet number 6, or did we decide we didn't need that one? We don't need it?
That's the one. Done.
Yes, I'm struggling to find it.
1, 2, 3. I think it's bullet number 6, 1, 2, 3.
I know it's number 6 down, but I've lost my place.
Okay, yeah.
You have it.
Let's pull it 6 to add that language.
So regarding the amendment to the Commission on Aging Bylaws, under Article 2, Objective and Purpose, the 6th bullet down, that's not correct.
Yeah,
the 6th bullet down. The Commission on Aging individuals, commissioners will serve as an ambassador for senior issues by increasing community awareness and report back to the full commission after they have done so.
Second. All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion is carried. And next month, we have home innovation and safety with Sue Doyle, an occupational therapist. So we hope to see you all then. Thank you so much.
Thank you. I just totally lost where I was.